Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the East County Underground. I'm your host, Steve Hunyar. I want to wish everyone, I hope you had a very blessed Christmas holiday. Engineering our program tonight, by the way, David Fox. Welcome back, Dave.
Steve.
That's good. Good to see you. Hope you had a good holiday.
Always.
Good. Also, hope everyone has a very happy new year. Thanks for listening tonight. Let's hope that this country and our society fares better in 2010 than it did in 2009. I'd like to urge you, before we start the program tonight, to check out the website at www.my1079.com. There's a lot of good information on there. Also, you can listen to previous programs on this show. And also, if the show isn't enough and you want to check out my written ramblings, you can go to www.sandiegonewsroom.com. That's all spelt out, sandiegonewsroom.com. A little bit of braggadocious self-promotion, if you don't mind. This is a special edition of the program. This show will not have a time limit. We're going to go on as long as necessary to get the messages across because of the guests that I am having. Of all the shows that I have done, I believe this is probably the most important. And by the end of the show, I think you'll agree. We'll take whatever time necessary to get the entirety of the message that I want to get in. But I do want to warn you that some of what you're going to hear tonight is relatively or can be a little bit graphic, and you may not want your children listening to it this evening. So again, if you have young ones in the room, either turn the radio off or down or ask those kids to go play in a different room if you don't mind. There are elements both, of course, within the United States and external forces that we all know of that want to dramatically change the United States of America. They find our republic to be an essentially oppressive society. They believe that a different, bigger government would be more fair and that our current democracy needs an overhaul, a basic, over-encompassing overhaul. It's a top-down initiative by an administration that's employing essentially unconstitutional tactics to steal power, and they're abusing their authority. I hear some examples. I think we've seen these last year. The recent EPA ruling that gave the president singular control over the carbon dioxide emissions. In other words, he couldn't get it done at Copenhagen. He couldn't get it done with a cap and trade bill. So he had the EPA make CO2 a toxic substance. So now he has control over it. He's, of course, running GM and Chrysler, the banks. They're forcing people to pay for health care. In fact, I just laid this on one of my future nephew-in-laws that he just got nailed on Christmas Day with another $1,500 tax for his wife, his future wife, and himself without any choice in the matter. There was, of course, TARP. In some cases, you're seeing a president trying to enact treaties without congressional ratification. The Congress must ratify a treaty before it comes law, and it has to be done by 67%, not a supermajority of 60, not the simple majority of 51%. This is a new game. It's a redefinition of America. Listen to what the president has to say about it.
We are 5 days away from fundamentally transforming the United States of America.
So there it is. President Obama wants to fundamentally transform America. Now, when we heard him say that, we thought he had something completely different in mind. It's clear now what his policies and what he would clearly like to do. But here's the thing, is we've had over 230 years of basically unprecedented liberties, and by that I mean there was no society like the United States prior to this. We've led the world in ways our forefathers probably could never have imagined. We've innovated. We've been the ones came up with the aircraft and the automobiles. And I mean, you look back at our history, it's amazing. And that's primarily because of our ability to have these liberties, to have these freedoms. Now we have a radical extremist element and a president and his political accomplices, some of whom are self-avowed communists. I'm not saying it. They're saying it. They're admitted to being communists. That they want to level the playing field, both nationally and internationally, bringing the United States down. It's not a matter of bringing everybody else up. It's a matter of bringing the United States down to everybody else's level. So we have a government that is blatantly ignoring the majority will of the people. And, in fact, they are now flaunting their power as they shot us down.
Ma'am, trying to have a conversation with you would be like trying to argue with a dining room table. I have no interest in doing it.
Mr. Coxford, don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining. Thank you. I would dignify you by peeing on your leg. It wouldn't be worth wasting the urine.
I don't think they're astroturfed. You be the judge of carrying swastikas and symbols like that at a town meeting on health care.
Those are Congressman Barney Frank, Pete Stark, and Nancy Pelosi. They want to control us vis-a-vis a new nanny state, and they berate us when we try to stand up for it. Isn't that lovely? The people that we elect are actually sitting there telling us we're astroturf, telling us that they wouldn't dignify us by peeing on our leg. this is the people that we elect. We got to throw all these bums out. I'm telling you, this is ridiculous. I think there's a movement to do that. Certainly, Chris Dodd, for example, saying today that he's not going to run for re-election is a great example of what the Democrats are in for. And hopefully, not just the Democrats, but any Republican that has done this too. They tell us they won't waste their time on us and demand, and they demean us when we have legitimate questions in town hall meetings, etc. The political graft and the corruption is at an all-time high. How did we get here? If you're regular listeners of this show, you know that I'm first-generation American. My parents escaped with my sister from communist Hungary during the Revolution of 56. After quite an ordeal, they legally immigrated to America. I want to say that again. They legally immigrated to America and eventually became naturalized U.S. citizens. In fact, my sister did too, I believe, at the age of 16. They realized the American dream, the one that they worked hard for, the one they came to this country for. They bought a home, they raised a family, they put my sister and I through college. And now they're comfortably retired, of course. But what conditions drove them to leave their nation of origin, their home, their family, to leave the bulk of both of their families behind? What most people don't know or don't remember about Hungary, which is in Eastern Europe, that it was a democracy before it became a communist state. So one of the things I want to talk tonight about is exactly how that happened. How did a democratic society, a parliamentary democracy, become a completely oppressive society in a few short years? If you want to understand how bad a society can get, how bad does a society actually have to get for 250,000 of its people to leave the country? Many of whom were extremely highly educated. So before I introduce my guest tonight, I want you each to consider for one moment how bad things would have to be here in the U.S. to get you to uproot your family, leave everything behind, everything you owned, everything that was important to you, and take one of the biggest risks that you would take leaving your home. So my guests tonight are my parents. I'd like you to please welcome Csaba and Gisela Hunyar. Dad, say hello.
Oh, hello, Stephen.
Mom?
Hey, hello, Steve.
How are you both tonight?
Thank you.
Good? Doing good?
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
My mom and dad are both joining us, Dave and I, tonight because I wanted to give both the man and the woman's perspective on what they went through. So let's take this a step at a time. Let's do this chronologically, and let's start with immediately after World War I, which was during, of course, up to World War I, Hungary was part of the Austria-Hungarian Empire, and which was a monarchy. So they were part of this monarchy, but immediately after World War I, after the Versailles Treaty was signed, Hungary was broken off into its own state, its own country, if you will, and it went from being partial to a monarchy to a democracy. And could you explain how that happened?
Yes, the treaty was in Trianon in 1920, and Hungary was really stripped almost two-thirds of its lands, its borders, mm-hmm. and some of them even given to the Australian monarch. It was a little bit blessing, though, because we got rid of the 250 years of Austrian suppression. And in 1919, after the First World War, there was a very short but very bloody communist uprising in Hungary, and communists marauding all over Hungary, you know, killed a lot of people. For example, my mother originally had a fiancé who didn't want any political or communist posters on his house, mm-hmm. so he was hung. He was killed.
Just hung
by
for
marauders.
That.
Yeah, marauders, communists. So the fortunately, this communist takeover was, they call this usually as a 100-day reign, was short, because Miklós Horthy, who was a high-ranking officer in the Austrian Monarchian Army, as a matter of fact, he was an admiral, mm-hmm. got some troops, and up front of the troops walked into Hungary and defeated the communists. Hmm. And that's where the point when a Hungarian parliament and democracy started in 1920.
So essentially, it was a democracy, a parliamentary democracy. Can you kind of give us an idea of what the structure of the politics of the state was?
Oh, it is quite similar, you know, to the Americans. They have an upper house and a lower house. They had the president, although he wasn't called the president, he was called the governor. Originally, there were some indications that people wanted him to be crowned, mm-hmm. but he said, no, we don't want any part of the monarchy, so he was called the governor. So we had the governor, upper house, lower house, Supreme Court.
So you had three branches, basically, similar to what we have today.
Yeah, three branches, basically, and as it went along, you know, it became almost better and better, and the practice of parliamentary democracy was better, yes.
In Mass, how educated are Hungarians, you know, during that post-World War I era? How, you know, and I want people to get a sense of what kind of a country Hungary was. It wasn't a third world country by any means.
Oh, no, no. Education was very good. As a matter of fact, the higher education gave a lot of scientists to the world. Some of them emigrated and invented a lot of things. So
sure.
It was a very highly accepted education. A couple of universities in Hungary were very well known and respected all over Europe. So people came to Hungary to get higher education. The so-called middle class, which became stronger and stronger, had a mandatory education until the age of 16, mm-hmm. I believe. And that, before that, at age of 14, they were parted. If they were not good students, they went to trade schools, and some of the trade schools provided very, very skilled people.
Technical schools.
Yeah, we would say that technical school. On the other hand, we had also a system called gymnasium, you know, based on old Latin words. Mm-hmm. Young students were enrolled from age of 10 to 18, which was preliminary to admission to higher education to universities.
Again, a pretty similar system to what we have here.
Yes, I would say so.
So a good public education system.
Yes.
With a very high priority on education for the public.
Right, the public education, but there were also private schools.
Of course. Were the people very nationalistic? Would you consider the Hungarians to be, during that period of time, very nationalistic people?
Yes, they are, and they were very nationalistic. Unfortunately, lately, it became, young people were taught about nationalism as a sin. You know, that's the latest communist propaganda and so on. But those times they were very nationalistic, and as a matter of fact, many Hungarians very much resented the original Trianon treaties. So providing large group of Hungarians in countries which were artificially made up, like Czechoslovakia, mm-hmm. Yugoslavia, out of six different, I wouldn't say tribes, but different people, mm-hmm. and Transylvania went to Romania, mm-hmm. with still a very large Hungarian population over there,
right.
And Hungarians resented that and always hoped and always strived to regain this and unite these Hungarians with the mother country.
Okay. Mom, did people own their old homes during that time between World War One and World War II?
Oh, yes.
So homeownership was...
I don't know about going that far because I was born in 1930, so, you know. But yes, my grandmother had a very nice house. Very, very. And both grandmothers.
And homeownership was a big component of the Hungarian society. Yeah. Would you both say, and Mom, you first, would you both say that... that the standard of living in Hungary was as good as anywhere else in the world?
Maybe not exactly, but it was pretty...
90% somewhere in there is
good. Yeah, I think so. And better, and so like, for instance, the Soviet Union, much better. Than
right, that. Right. But compared to Europe, United States, you know, Germany, France...
Because they were not traveling as much, the people, but I remember some of my family went to Vienna and shopping, and you know, you were free to go. So that's the main
thing. You were free to go like anybody
free
here.
To go. Yeah.
Well, if you can believe that, that's already our first segment. I have to take my first break. So when we come back, I want to continue along this line of discussions. This is Steve Hunyar, East County Underground. My guests tonight are my very own parents talking about what happened in communist Hungary and how they got there. And we'll talk a little bit about what they see today in the United States. Steve Hunyar, we'll be back after these commercial messages. Welcome back to East County Underground. Thanks for hanging in there with us. This is My 107.9 FM. I'm your host, Steve Hunyar. Engineering, with a big smile on his face tonight, is David Fox, of course. My guests this evening are my parents. We're talking about their experiences growing up in Hungary, the changes that they had on a lot of different levels. I want to get to what happened there and how they are a little bit afraid of what may be coming down the road here in the United States. So anyway, we left off talking about living standard in Hungary being very comparable to Europe, the rest of Europe, the United States. I'm kind of interested now in the social structure. What was the social structure of Hungary? Was it homogenous? Were there minorities? Was it, you know, what was the social structure?
Actually, the social structure was very homogeneous. We had naturally some minorities like gypsies, but they were only very, very, less than 1% of the population. Also, Hungary had a lot of German-speaking people, but they were immigrants from older times, and they never really were regarded as minorities. As a matter of fact, some of them played very, very great role in the Hungarian society. So I would say they were really homogenous. All white people, they are all homogenous.
Were the gypsies oppressed in any way? Was anybody really, was there any form of racism, so to speak?
In such, no, but gypsies were rather undereducated. And most of the time they lived about music, you know, they played Hungarian songs. By the way, gypsy music is not Hungarian, but they played Hungarian folk songs with their orchestras, you know. And they lived in separate little enclaves to each village. So in this way, you would say they were a little bit segregated.
Okay. What were the largest religions, Mom?
Catholic.
Catholic. Were there also a lot of Protestants?
Not a lot, but they are.
So it was all
Catholic.
Almost all Christian.
And, yeah.
Was there any Islam or any other faiths of any kind? Jewish?
I would say that about 60% of the population was Roman Catholic. 30-35% were Protestants, you know, different among the Lutherans,
sure,
and so on. And we had about 4% of Jewish population.
All right. So was there religious freedom? Was any religion, were any religions oppressed in any way?
Absolutely.
Anybody could practice any faith they wanted,
anything.
Witchcraft, if
yes,
they wanted to.
No.
Yes.
No. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Could you come and go in Hungary as you pleased?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There were no travel restriction whatsoever. You traveled anywhere you want, for vacation or something. And you could travel to Europe or anywhere in the world.
With a passport or something
like
that.
Yes, you had passports. You had to acquire passports, but you could travel all over the place.
I'm trying to lay a foundation for people here. I hope you understand that. Now, what other kinds of freedoms did you have? Could you own and carry guns?
I never have seen anybody or known everybody to own a gun. It just wasn't in the society. We didn't ever try to resolve any problems using guns. So, but as far as ownership, nobody really cared. So
there was,
you could own guns if you wanted to. If you wanted to, but nobody really wanted to.
Now, what about speaking out against the government? Could you speak out at will against the government?
Yes.
Could you stand on a
so.
Corner and shout, I hate this government?
I was a young girl, but I think so.
You don't remember.
I never seen that, but I am sure it was possible. And
there were several newspapers, you know, criticizing the government all the time, so it was...
Not state-run papers.
No,
not the mainstream media,
you know,
then, huh?
Made fun of them, the government.
Okay,
all
like a newspaper should.
Yeah. And
all
the comics on the stage.
Were privately owned. There were no government newspapers.
No state papers.
No state papers.
Okay, good. All right, let's fast forward now to World War II. And I know that, again, some of this is difficult for you to talk about, so I appreciate you coming here to talk about this. The Hungarians, Dad, we talked a little bit about this earlier, but the Hungarians were kind of, during World War II, forced into trade agreements with Germans, or prior to World War II. What was the sense of most Hungarians as the war began and Hitler started his campaign in 39 and slowly started to take over the rest of Europe? What was the sense of most Hungarians? Because generally, Hitler didn't really bother Hungary for a long time. But what did Hungarians actually, what did the common Hungarian think about Germans, Germany and Hitler?
We were always in the German economic sphere. So our international business and so on were very much tied to Germany. That's true. On the other hand, really, nobody wanted to have a war. Not whatsoever. As a matter of fact, when we were forced by the Germans, then Gróf Teleki, the Hungarian prime minister in 1941, committed suicide to protest it.
The prime minister committed suicide?
The prime minister committed suicide to protest the German pressure for us to align with the Germans.
Economically. And again, the war effort as well?
Yes. And the Hungarians were really tricked into also by the Germans when they invaded Russia or the Soviet Union.
Right.
They also occupied many of... got hold of many of the Russian planes on the ground.
Mm-hmm, sure.
They manned these planes by German pilots and bombed two Hungarian cities. It was a nice trick, wasn't it?
How did the Hungarians eventually find out?
You know, the Hungarians didn't like it. And that was also one which kind of forced us into the war. But it wasn't really...
backhanded tactics.
No, it was... No, Hungarians didn't want war.
Yeah. Now... How did life change for you in the early days of the war before 1941? How did life change for you both? Mom, why don't you go first?
Well, you know, during the war there was shortage, and then later it was bombing Budapest. But for me, it was mostly not too bad, but small little food.
You were a young teenager
yeah.
then.
Yeah, I was a young kid.
So some food shortages.
Some food was, they would give you limited amount or monthly supply. I don't remember exactly what, but it wasn't too bad.
Now, who was bombing Hungary?
Well, the English.
So the Allies.
Americans.
The Allies.
Yes.
And only 1944.
Early on, up until that point, life was pretty much still normal.
Yes.
You still had the democracy?
And there were some regulations about travels and so on. So it comes with the war.
Some basic restrictions. But generally speaking, you still had the democracy was still in place.
Yeah.
You still had the three houses of government ruling. These trade associations were in place with the Germans who were kind of forcing a heavy hand. But generally speaking, life itself really didn't change all that much until later in the war. As you said, the Hungarians were kind of brought into the war against the Soviets. And I know the Hungarians started negotiating a peace agreement with the Allies. And then Hitler found out or somehow or was told or whatever the circumstances were. And he occupied Hungary in 1944 because he found out that the Hungarians were trying to negotiate a peace. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Stephen, we were betrayed.
Okay.
Hitler didn't just found it out. It was leaked from the Western Allies.
Do you know by who? Does anybody ever find out who did it?
Never, but it was leaked. So Hitler became angry, and in 1945 March, the German troops actually occupied Hungary.
Took over and said that's it.
Took over. Government, everything.
And what was life like during that German occupation when they came in and the hammer fell?
That was tough.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Personal freedom was out. And that was toward the end of the war, the last year of the war. Many of Hungarian young people died on the Russian fronts. The Germans betrayed us because they pulled back at the Don River and left the whole front to protect for Hungarians and Romanian troops.
Mm-hmm.
The Romanian troops just gave up. They walked
they
out.
Just...
And the Hungarians lost several hundred thousand young people out there.
So the Germans retreated, but they left the Hungarians there to fight the war for them. Knowing full well that the Soviets were going to take...
Yeah, that was there toward the end, yeah.
Now, there was a time when the Russians had pretty well surrounded Hungary, and eventually the Germans retreated. Can you explain, I'd like both of you, and Mom, if you don't mind, go first. Can you explain what that period of time was like? It was a relatively short period of time, correct? 8 weeks or something of that order, just a couple months?
Are you talking about the occupation of Budapest?
Yes. Essentially, the Budapest was occupied by Germans, and then the Russians had pretty well surrounded everything, and the Germans retreated. What was life like then?
Yeah, that was tough, because we all had to live in bunkers, you know, and just get the basic needs, you know, in the bunkers, it was very difficult. And, of course, food was limited, and this was very scary, the whole thing, because it's nonstop. You heard the bombing, and the house I was living was bombed twice. And we just had to live down in the bunkers, you know, and there was nothing else to do. And we were kids, but we made the best of it, you know, running around and talking and playing games. And the parents were trying to, you know, take them, oh, nothing to be afraid of and all that. But, of course, it was very scary.
Sure. You were about 15?
No, I was 14.
14, 15?
Yeah.
Jacqueline's age.
Yeah, so it was, that was really, really difficult time.
How about you, Dad?
Actually, another betrayal, because Hitler proclaimed Paris and Rome as open cities, so those cities were saved. But they gave the order to fight to the last man in Budapest, so leaving the city, good part of the city, in total ruins.
They basically told the Germans to stay put and fight the Russians?
Yeah, but Hungarian already gave up. There was a declaration in October 15, armistice by the Hungarians. The Hungarians said, the war is over for us. So the Germans were fighting in Hungary against the Russians.
Now, you were shot at several times during that time, and you actually got shot. Well, I know you don't like to talk about this. Dad, I know, but people need to understand the gravity of the situation there. I want you to tell a story about how you were shot.
I was 17 years old, and I was the last born in 1927 who were not proscribed in the army. So as a young movement, you know, tried to be taken out to Germany by the Germans. We didn't do it. So we were actually fugitives. And the Germans tried to round us up, I was shot once in the leg.
You didn't even know it immediately from what I...
yeah, that was funny because I was running for my life, you know, and I didn't even feel it being shot. The bullet came between the two bones. Fortunately, it didn't hit any bones.
Or the vein, the major artery there.
No, fortunately, it was... The bleeding stopped, and what? All I know is my boot was full with the congealed blood, but that was it.
That's amazing. People here have no clue. You know what? I need to take my next break. So why don't we take our break at the bottom of the hour? We'll come back afterwards. I'm going to continue with this discussion. This is Steve Hunyar, East County Underground, My 107.9 FM. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the East County Underground. This is Steve Hunyar and David Fox with you tonight. My parents, Chubba and Gisela Hunyar, are here talking about World War II, the revolution, life in general in communist Hungary. And where we left off was that the Germans had just retreated from Hungary during World War II, leaving the Russians there. Would you both explain to me the difference between the German occupation and the Russian occupation?
Both very much impression. There's just no freedoms whatsoever. No personal or the government didn't have any freedom either. So,
well, was one occupation worse than the other?
Yes. First of all, it lasted much longer.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
The actually German occupation was about 9 months, and the Russian occupation, you know, just lasted almost forever. The second thing is that the Germans still left us some dignity. Not much, but left us some dignity, whereas during the Russian occupation, everything was out.
The Germans would it be okay to say they were a little more civilized?
I wouldn't say Russian occupation. It would be Soviet.
Soviet occupation. Mom, remember, the people on the other side can't hear you nodding.
Yes,
you can say yes.
I know that, but it's yes.
Now, Mom,
much more civilized, I think.
There were two, Dad, you had told me that there were essentially, during the Russian occupation, there were two sets of forces that came in. The Soviet occupation. The second set of Soviet soldiers were a little more brutal, and one of the things I want, and I know, Mom, this is tough to talk about, but there were rape gangs of Russian Soviet soldiers at the time. Is that true?
Absolutely.
So a lot of women were brutalized sexually in Hungary during that time. Mom, now this is the one thing that I know is very difficult for you to talk about, and I know. But I really would like people to know what happened to my grandfather, who I'm named after. And at the end of the war, Stalin had literally murdered roughly, what, 40 million people? Russians and other peoples, right?
Yes.
Roughly.
Yes.
And he had to account for those people because he had told the world, the League of Nations, etc., that he had a large number of POWs.
You think so he cared?
Well, then why did he round up and take... Mom, tell the story. What happened to Grandpa?
Apparently, he signed paper daily. I don't know if that's true, but that's not the history, what they claim. That he signed daily that we had that much people and this, you know. And so they finally didn't have that. They gathered of civilian, which was just came down in the bunker. And when somebody was 16 to I don't know, 60, they just said, you have to come and work a little bit.
Men. Yep.
And they took all the men out of the bunker. We didn't know where they go, what they're going to do, but they said little robotnik, which means a little work, you know. And so my father was taken away, and my grandmother's house, which was not too far where I lived, walking distance, they took my mom's only brother, who was 46, and they took him in his pajamas and the slippers, and they didn't allow him. He didn't give him time to get dressed in something, you know, warmer, because it was winter, very cold, mm-hmm. snow on the ground and all those. So he never came back. My father was away. We didn't know where he was. We didn't know anything about him. So my mom was there with a 5-year-old and the 14-year-old kid with no food, no nothing. And finally they said, you have to leave the bunker. And it was very tough because the gunshots were flying all over and we had to leave. And we walked a long, long time. Finally, somebody's relative or something, they said, come on in and stay and warm, and they made us tea. And we stayed one night, and then finally we had a chance to go back to my grandmother's house. And then we were there for about, oh, I would say 6 weeks mm-hmm. or 8 weeks, rather, staying with my grandmother's house, and we didn't know what happened to our home. We had no idea, no nothing. And actually, Budapest is two cities combined into one. One city, one part of it is Pest, the other side is Buda, and that was happening in Buda because Pest was fallen much earlier. Buda was hilly, and the German troops kind of dug themselves into this hillside. Mm-hmm. And the Russians were always drunk, the soldier, because they find a lot of wine around in Buda. So it took 8 weeks to get Buda, and we had to go for water into far away because the water shut down, no electricity, not enough food, and it was just a very, very unbelievably rough time. The roughest thing was that we didn't know where Dad is. We had no idea. They just took him, and we didn't know where or how or why. Nothing.
How long was he gone?
He was gone for 7 months, and it was quite incidental that survived because my godfather, whom I talked about in the pajamas, he never came back. We don't know where he died. We have not the slight idea. We never could find out, and that was not just him, thousands of people. My father was one of the lucky ones, one of the few lucky ones who survived it. And then the company, which was the electrical company of Budapest, they applied to the Russians. When after they find out where he is, he was way, way south of Hungary in a city called Baja, in a camp. And they got him out after 7 months.
But the electric
last,
company got
last
him out.
Month, last 2 weeks or 3 weeks, we knew he was survived, and he's in Baja, the city. But up till then, we never knew anything.
How did he look when he came home?
When he came home, I didn't recognize him. I never... This is one of the hardest, really hard times to talk about, because somebody rang the bell. My mother laid down. She was very ill, very sick, very thin. And some stranger, and I looked, yes, what can I do? What can I help you with? And he just looked at me and he said, you don't recognize the little one? And I didn't.
He was that malnourished.
So bad, and just that moment, I never forget that, ever.
Okay. Thanks.
Probably I can explain something here. The Russians, Soviet, probably the higher echelon declared that they took 600,000 prisoners of the Hungarian army. The Hungarian army never had 600,000. The most was 400,000. So actually they just filled up that quota from civilians.
With civilian men.
To ship them to Siberia.
What percentage of men out of the thousands and thousands, what percentage came back?
A couple percent? 10%. I don't know. Because many of them spent years in Siberia's gulags and camps, you know, and many of them perished. They were just put them in wagons and moved them out and shipped them to Paris to fulfill the quota.
All right. Let's talk about after the war now. Immediately after the war ended, most people, and myself included, initially thought that Hungary immediately became a communist country. That, in fact, is not the case. Can you tell us what happened to Hungary immediately after the war?
No, not at all.
And this was under Soviet control, was it not?
Yeah, the Soviet troop controlled the Hungary, but the government, they couldn't control the government because they didn't have the means, they didn't have the people. So in 1945, after the Germans finally gave up, Hungary finally had an election. And the funny thing is that there were 20 parties to try to qualify, 13 qualified for the election.
13 political parties.
13 political parties, okay. Yes. There was a saying in Hungary, where there are two Hungarians, there must be three political parties.
Okay.
You know, and in that election, the communists only got 11% of the votes.
So clearly they were outnumbered.
Totally. So the Hungarians didn't want the Communist Party,
right.
11% of the votes. So in 1947, 2 years later, there was an election, and the Communists even got less votes. So the Communists realized, the Russians or Communists realized,
Soviets.
Finally, yeah, Soviets, realized finally that they never will take power by
the legitimate way.
Means, by elective means.
Okay.
So in 1948, Russian troops just moved in and took over all the government functions, the radios, the parliament, the newspapers, everything they took over. And Hungary became declared as a communist state.
And as the world stood by and watched?
Nobody lifted a little finger.
All right, well, what was life like under communism, Mom? Are you okay now?
Yeah, I'm fine. Thank you. Well, it started out, first of all, you couldn't move around. So if you wanted to travel like anywhere, just in Hungary, inside of Hungary, you have to get a permit to go. We got what you have now, kind of a little booklet, which you had to carry it all the time, because they would stop you anywhere in the street of Budapest, the police or the AVH, which was the, I don't know how you translate
secret
that.
Secret police, right?
Yeah. And you had to show them your papers.
On demand, anytime.
On demand, anytime. If you didn't have it with you, you get into real trouble. They probably will arrest you. Maybe they let you go later on. But anyway, you would be in real trouble. With the paper, you had your pictures on, and they could do any time. And then it started, the everyday life was shortages, standing in line for a certain amount of food or this or that, which we didn't have that few years which we were free, it started to get after the war really nice. Not everything, because it was just short time after the war, but it started to come alive. And then it started to go to the back other direction. Instead of improving our life living standard, it went down.
For everybody.
For everybody.
Except for the few
Except
elitists.
Except the few elitists.
The leaders.
Elitists, of course. And it was just no more freedom. You know, you couldn't go, you couldn't get to go out of the country. That was absolutely.
Yeah, they weren't going to let you leave.
No, no. Anywhere. Not even the surrounding communist country.
Right.
You couldn't go.
Now, they told you where to work.
They told you where to work. They told you what education you can have. Like, for instance, my brother, who was 8 years younger, wanted to go and be kind of a forest engineer, mm-hmm. forest managing engineer. Mm-hmm. He couldn't do that because, no, you have to go into whatever.
Academia. I mean, he turned to end up being a professor of history, right?
Yeah, later, much
right,
later.
Right.
And but he couldn't go be what he really wanted and was very unhappy that he had to go and study something else, completely different.
Okay, what about where you lived?
Our apartment was still okay. Then we got married. No apartment whatsoever. That was out of the question that we can get a housing. We tried every which way because you're... It was mostly his fault. If he has to tell you why. No, because he was against communism.
Against communism, bigger. Yeah.
So and
yeah, be careful how you say that, yeah.
So he was a...
Go ahead, chime up, Dad. It's okay.
You want to talk about our marriage?
I'll tell you.
Our marriage. No, right, it's just our housing situation, not our marriage. So we got finally a small little unit in my grandmother's house, and but we had to go outside to go to the toilet, which is, that's kind of personal talk about it, but it was very, we went to take a bath to my mother every end of the week because we didn't have a bathroom. We just couldn't,
right.
You know, they didn't give it to us. We didn't deserve it.
So
we were not faithful communists.
In
you
a
know.
Nutshell, they told you where to live. And
yeah, how. Yeah, that's right. So... No, it's not that. It just you couldn't. And for instance, we got married in the church and openly. Most people young people went down somewhere in a little village and got married secretly in the church.
Right.
But we got married kind of openly, and we didn't make a big fuss about it.
By a priest?
By a priest.
Ooh.
And you continue because what happened to you after they realized it that we got married in the church?
We got back from our honeymoon, you know, short little place, you know, up at the lakes. And next day I was transferred to a sulfuric acid factory.
A sulfuric acid factory.
In the night shift, as a matter of fact.
So getting married, okay, let me clear, I want to be very clear on this. So getting married in a church was enough of an offense.
Who?
Secretly getting married in a church was enough of an offense that they transferred you from one job to the night shift of a sulfuric acid factory.
Right. That was correct. As a matter of fact, we always knew that there would be some reprisals, but they were swift.
They didn't wait.
No.
All right. We have to take another break. So I want to stay right there because I want to talk. This is a perfect segue into religious freedoms in communist country. This is Steve Hunyar, East County Underground. We'll be back, right after these commercial messages. Welcome back to East County Underground. This is Steve Hunyar, my 107.9 FM. I am talking to my parents tonight. Their lives, both of them growing up in a communist country. We were talking about how life finally was, how it became completely under the control of the Soviet Union under communism in 1948, and we were talking about how my dad was transferred to an sulfuric acid production facility in the night shift because they got married secretly married in a church. Was there any religious freedom in Hungary at all? Did the Soviets grant anybody any kind of religion?
No.
So, Dad, you were going to say something else.
They left some churches open, and they created some so-called communist priest, you know. They allowed them who were talking about the greatness of the communist revolution.
So the church... The church split. I see. So basically that communism became the state religion.
Right. That was almost like a religion.
Atheism.
Atheism.
Atheism, yeah.
So atheism was the actual deity, but basically the religion was communism.
Yeah.
It was a theology in a way.
Theology was communism. It was Marxism-Leninism.
Mom, you remember years ago I asked you, how would they control? You'd see photos of these communist. Would they get people together with signs and they'd be at parades, May Day parades, and they'd all be, you know, standing there holding their parades, going, yeehaw, yeehaw, oh, you know, communism is great, wonderful. How did they do that?
Well, if you happen to decide not to go, it was like in the election. Election is the same way.
Well, no, but...
They came for you.
No.
The police came for you. You had to go.
Well, but how did they do that? I mean, because you're talking 10 million Hungarians.
Well,
so,
I honestly, it's very hard to discuss.
Didn't they had political officers in every company, didn't they?
They had political officers, every company, probably every apartment, which you didn't know.
Oh,
but
like the Sky Marshals, huh?
Like kind of, you didn't know, but it was there.
It's not funny, though.
It's not funny. And you just had to go. And this now happening, like I see it in Venezuela, because I am absolutely 100%.
Mom, talk directly into the microphone,
sure,
please.
Sure that those people, probably one-tenth of it would like to really go, and the rest of them doesn't. Believe me.
And we, Dad, you and I have been to Venezuela.
It's so obvious to me. Probably not the American people, but to me, if I look at the pictures of that in Venezuela, it's absolutely sure to me that they are being forced.
But you haven't been there. I want to talk about specifically, Dad, how did you feel? How did they control you?
Very simple. Consequences. If you didn't do what they wanted to do, you might just disappear. They come 2 o'clock in the morning, knock on your door, and nobody will ever see you again.
No.
And the fear, the dominating fear in the whole country, was that what controlled the country.
Well, you were something of a rebel, right? You got married in that church, and you got in trouble. Why didn't they just ship you off?
Why? I was probably a little bit lucky, and my education saved me.
How did it save you?
Yes, because I was a diploma in engineering, and they still needed us. They had the 3 and 5 year plans, which totally went south. So they needed somebody who saved the economy. So they give some incentives, you know, for the young engineering class, which was very oppressed before, to come up and then... You know, you won't get as bad treatment as you would otherwise.
But why did the economy tank?
Why?
Yeah.
First of all, there was no ambition whatsoever.
No incentive.
No incentive, not whatsoever. Everybody got paid in the owned government-owned factory the same wage, no matter how hard he worked, how poorly he worked. So people didn't. Wasn't interested of. Why should I work hard when I didn't get any more?
Sound like a union to you, Dave? Sorry.
It does.
A little too much.
Yeah, so there was no incentive. And on the other hand, the planning was absolutely and totally, totally wrong.
The way they planned the economy.
The 5 year plan. For example, they gave us quota to produce so many this and this merchandise.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't give us the materials. Then we were blamed to sabotaging their plans.
Because you didn't have the raw materials to make the finished goods.
We didn't have the raw materials to do the work with.
Now, in the latter part, prior to the Hungarian Revolution of 56, you experienced hyperinflation, which many economists believe the United States, the U.S. dollars headed for.
Now, watch out. It wasn't caused by the communism. It was caused by the last war. It was caused by the total collapse of distribution system. You know, to bring, for example, food from the land to the main cities.
Mm-hmm.
It was also caused by the shortages, simple shortages. A black market developed, and the prices were going up, 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 up all the time. So the government printed more and more money, and the Russian, invading Russians, also printed Hungarian money. So the money was diluted so badly, there was no more place on the note for the zeros.
Yeah.
One after 15 or 20 or 30 or 40 zeros.
I've seen these notes. I've seen
that. Yeah. We got paid in the morning, and that money was no good in the afternoon. So in 1945, June, for example, we got paid twice every day.
Mm-hmm.
So we ran out to the nearest shop, tried to buy a loaf of bread, and in the afternoon, that money wasn't worth a loaf, it wasn't worth anything. So that was the more horrible example how the money just lost any whatsoever value.
How did they recover from that?
Excuse me?
How did Hungary recover from that? I know they introduced a new currency. That was the
Penge. They introduced a new currency in 1942, 1st of August.
And when was that, Dad? Say that again.
1946.
46, okay.
Yeah, that was still in the Democratic Party. They introduced the currency, which became inflated later on, but at a much slower pace.
Right, more like a normal currency would.
Yes.
So they just basically said, that's it, the Penge, right? That's what it was called?
The Penge was gone.
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 And we're
going to
totally replace
gone.
It, and we're going to sign a new monetary note that has a certain value.
And anything based, you know, like contracts and so on, based on Penge, were totally gone.
Or your bank account.
So money and savings was worthless?
It's gone. Everything. It's gone. Everything.
Whatever retirement savings elderly people had put away?
Gone.
Wiped
gone.
Out. Gone. Pensions?
Gone. Yeah.
So money, as Hungarians knew it, pretty much ceased to exist.
Yes.
It was like starting completely over.
In 1946, the country became a trading system, a bartering,
bartering
system. Bartering. We had to go to the villages and barter and trade our clothes. First, the jewelry was gone. And after that, our clothes were gone, you know, to get something to eat.
Literally, you were having to
yes,
give the clothes off your back, so to speak, to feed yourselves.
If you had any.
If you had some. Yeah, because after the war, everything, a lot of things
yeah,
were wiped
it
out.
It was a joke because it said every peasant in the country has now a piano.
Oh, that was the joke?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Because, you know, they didn't, or a violin, they didn't want to exchange anymore, so they kind of, this was a value. Let's change this. So it was a joke, but some truth in it, you know.
All right. Now, let's go to the Hungarian Revolution, which started on October 23rd, 1956, and it lasted, what, about 3 to 4 weeks?
About three weeks. It started on October 23. The Russians first pulled their troops out because they were not willing to fire on the Hungarian workers and students
Who started it?
Started the revolution. So they were pulled back. And on November the 3rd, the Politburo decided in Moscow that the troops should be reintroduced. They brought in fresh troops. And unfortunately, within a week or so, they won.
So what? Okay, you know what? We're at pretty much the top of the hour, so let me give the call signals. This is KRLYLP Alpine. This is my 107.9 FM. You're listening to the East County Underground. I'm your host, Steve Hunyar. Continue, Hungarian Revolution. There was a period. What factors led up to the revolution?
The factors were simply that people got fed up. They had no future, nothing. It was like the French Revolution, the sans-culottes. They didn't even have a pair of pants. The people just got fed up with it. And slowly by slowly, here and there, there were a little oppositional, an article in the newspaper which made some little criticism. Just a little one,
mm-hmm.
not allowed too much. But that started to snowball. And finally it came to a point when Hungarians started to say, no, we want freedom. And led to street fights against the secret police and the, you know, and so on.
Sure.
And on October 23rd, it broke into a full war.
How large was the revolution? So how many Hungarians actually participated in it, do you think?
The whole country. either actively by fighting on the streets with weapons, which they confiscated from the army or whatever, you know, they had done the police and so on,
mm-hmm.
but also by resistance. A general strike was called. Nobody was going to work. See, all the factories belong to the state. So the general strike was nobody wanted to go to work. Everybody went on the streets and so on.
Mom, what did you experience during this time? When the revolution started on the 23rd, what were you experiencing, your family?
Well, it was a lot of excitement.
I mean, you were married,
yeah,
I realize,
married.
But,
we had,
but your side
Maria,
of your...
Maria,
yeah.
You know, the little, my girl. And just listened to the radio, and I thought, God, help us all, you know, and these young people who were fighting. And otherwise, I didn't participated in it because I was a young mother, and where we lived in Buda, that was kind of a outskirt. I mean, and the fighting was around the parliament and
Pest.
Most
yeah,
Pest,
to the listeners, Budapest is actually one city divided by yeah. the Danube River. The flat area, which is the parliament side, is yeah. the Pest side, and the hilly side, which yeah. is across the river from there, is the Buda side. So when you, if you've ever been there or if you look at Google, you'll know what I'm talking about now. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and your father, because he was working, he went into the factory, and they opened up the secret files in the factory.
Of the employees?
Yeah, of the employees. By, you know, and they did
Dad's
it
laughing.
Everywhere. They did that. It just was like...
Enough hey, is enough?
Enough is enough. And the other thing, we have to a little bit talk about it, but we really resented that everything, all the time, radio, newspaper, anything you went to, the great Russia, the great Soviet Union, and they discovered everything, and you had to listen to that absolute BS day and night that... The radio was not Marconi, but it was a blah, 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 something Russian, you know. All the time, that was on, and finally people said, hey, we are not that dumb to take this all the time.
Welcome to America.
Look up to the gate Russia, you know.
Stephen, can I just inject something?
Yeah, of course.
Here? The worst part of the Soviet times, you know, until 1946, was the indoctrination of the youth. They started at the age of six when mm-hmm. you went to the school. You had to sing in choirs, you know, to sing to the oaths, to the great leader, Stalin, you know, mm-hmm. and everything Russia was good.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
what's worse,
mm-hmm.
they
Barack
had,
Hussein Obama.
And then in the youth, so-called youth organization, they forced the kids and taught them how to spy on their and rat on their own parents. And
yeah.
that
the Hitler youth, similar to that, what Hitler did with the Jugend, right?
Yeah. Absolutely.
That I would like to just interject that how yeah. bad was those times.
Okay, now, Dad, you've told me there was a time, there was a period of time there during the revolution that that Hungary could have been spared from communism if someone, if the UN had stepped in. What would it have taken for Hungary to be spared? The Soviets had pulled out.
The first few days, the Soviet troops were pulled out because they were unreliable for the viewpoint.
Right.
Then in the Kreml, we now know that there was a big argument in the Politburo for or against to return Hungary. And finally, that section went out who said, if we let Hungary go, then so will other Soviet-related states like Poland, Czechoslovakia, and so on, rise up again. And then on November 3rd, they brought in the troops. We had about 6-7 days of quiet period in there. And if this, during this time, the UN would come in just with a few troops, you know, like Swedish or Norwegian or any kind
didn't
of
even
troops.
Have to be the
Russians wouldn't come back.
They would not have come back? You're convinced
no,
of that?
They wouldn't come back. We know that from the archives.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from the Russian archives.
What did the Russians do to Hungary when they came back?
Oh, the revolution was very bad. They arrested many people. They hung the leaders. And That's why many people tried to flee and fled to Austria, and later when the Austrian border was closed up completely toward Yugoslavia, that's how we got out.
But they destroyed blocks. They came in with tanks and leveled blocks.
Oh,
did they
not?
I mean, they decimated parts of the city.
I have shown you some pictures of Hungary in 1956.
Yeah. But people need to understand it. They didn't just roll in and say that's it. They rolled
in. No, there were fights.
In full force.
No, there were full force
tanks.
Fights, tanks.
Against Hungarians who were armed with what?
With Molotov cocktails, which meant that a bottle like this filled up
gasoline
and throw them.
Yeah, and a few sidearms if you were lucky enough.
Nothing, and, you know, it was unbelievable.
Now, your families made two attempts to escape Hungary to freedom. The first attempt was, Mom, it was on your side, right? And what happened? You were trying to go to Austria, correct? Am I correct?
Yeah, but
tell the story, please.
His parents.
Well, you all went together.
Went together.
Okay.
And then we got closer to sleeping in a peasant house, and we got much closer to the border.
Mm-hmm.
And they took us in. They were absolutely wonderful.
Hungarians,
absolutely wonderful. They gave us food and sister, your little sister, Abed, and they were just marvelous.
Older sister, Mom.
Yeah. Well, she was still very, yeah,
I know,
but
what
she
mean.
Was very
I
little.
Do. I know.
She
Maria,
was only
hi,
three and a half. So anyway, they were really lovely. And what happened, the grandmothers heard the shooting at night.
Your mother and dad's mother?
Yeah. And I said, no, something will happen to the little girl, you know, Maria, oh, God, she can get killed. Let's go back.
So you went back.
So we went back.
So later, you made the decision, Mom, Dad, and Maria.
In secret. We didn't tell the family, which was very painful. We left a
you didn't
little
tell
note
either?
Later on, but we didn't tell because they would have just so upset that we wouldn't be able to do it in just to feeling guilty.
And by that time, the Austrian border, Austria-Hungary border had closed, so you were forced to go to Yugoslavia, correct?
Yeah. We were forced to go to south, which was really bad, very bad, and we knew it will be bad.
And there's
Yugoslavia was also another communist state. You know,
but not Soviet, right?
Not Soviet.
Yeah.
And I know there was a story of how you ran into a Yugoslav soldier in the middle of the night, and you swore it was a... Tell that story. I think people need to hear this.
It was snow, and we hired somebody who, with a horse carriage, took us as close to the border as he was able to, and they said, from there on, you have to walk that direction. And it was cold, it was winter, it was at night, you know, snow on the ground. All of a sudden, somebody in the darkness said, stoy, which is to stop,
right.
You know, in Russian.
In Russian, right?
Or Russians or
Yugoslavian
Serbians. Language.
It happened to be the same word?
It's the same word.
It's the same word.
Oh,
and
great.
All of a sudden, he comes forward, a young man, tall, blonde guy, and had the buttons on, and the uniform was exactly like a Russian. Exactly. And I just lost it, and I grabbed one of the buttons, you know, because I knew if it's a Russian, that's it.
Yeah.
We're going to get killed or put into whatever. That was it. So he saw my absolute fear, and he said, "Not Russian, not Russian." Which means
not the Russian. He was telling you he was a Yugoslavian soldier.
He was a Yugoslavian who had the same uniform as a Russian. So I thought I'm going to faint right there. I was so scared, obviously. But then he took over. He carried Maria and helped us. He had a machine gun, so of course. Even that looked like a Russian, and it was a Russian probably weapon. But he took us in a small little house, and just where they have to serve, you know. And then from then,
they put you in an internment camp. Eventually, there's a whole story that
it's a long story.
You made it. Eventually, my folks made it to Paris, stayed in Paris for 9 months, and then got a legal visa to the United States with sponsors from our family. In Cleveland.
Also, it helped that I got on the first preference quota. You know, this is for engineers and highly
educated. Again, because of your education.
Because, yeah. Yes, because of my education.
But at the same time, the Yugoslavians wanted to hold on to you because of your education. Isn't that right?
Yes, they tried to force us to stay, saying that there is a new factory being built in Zagreb, and I was given a high position in plant manager of chief engineer over there because they need my skill. And so I didn't want to stay from one communist state to the other one.
Yeah, imagine
so
if you'd
that
stayed there.
Wasn't that simple as he said it. It's a complicated story.
Of course.
But everything else is a complicated story when you live in there.
So when did you leave? What date was that? When did you leave Hungary? What date was that?
June 21st, 1957.
January 21st.
So 3 months after the revolution started and had ended, pretty much.
Pretty much they took care of
the revolution, the Soviet troops and the communists.
But you are convinced had somebody stepped in just for that short period of time, that 1 week, Hungary would have been saved from Iron Curtain.
No idea how uplifting that revolution was. Like, for instance, somebody broke a window, like a shoe store window, and nobody took anything. Nobody stole anything.
They didn't steal anything.
Nothing.
No looting.
It was no looting.
It was looting from a fellow Hungarian.
Yeah. It was just so uplifting. So I can't even explain.
So 10 million Hungarians came together, basically, all at once.
In small cities, everywhere, the peasants who were, you know, on fields. And they just with their own home. And they helped. They give you food if they had the chance to give it to you. You know, it just.
I want to mention something. The night before we left Hungary in January, I went to my best friend and asked him, Frank, you want to come along? We are leaving tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And he turned to me and said, what's going to happen to this poor country if every nice guy leaves it?
Oof.
And that remark haunted me for years and years.
Now, I know the first time you went back, Mom, you went back with a friend in 1968.
Yeah.
And you unfortunately happened to pick probably one of the worst times to go because while you were there, the Czechoslovakian Revolution started and tanks started rolling through the Soviet
Russian
tanks.
Russian troop gave, and my brother woke me up and said, the Russian troops are coming and the tanks.
Now, fortunately, it was not. You managed to come home just fine. 2 years later,
I went.
You took me there and Maria.
Yeah.
And I have my experiences from there as well.
Yeah, but I have to tell you, in between, my father died very unexpectedly in a heart attack. And it was 1960, and I couldn't go home to his funeral.
Right.
Because if I would go, I would be arrested. In 1968, they gave amnesty to the Hungarian who left the country. The Hungarian recognized that it was their fault that this happened, so they gave amnesty, and I was able to go home the first time. But I couldn't go to my father's funeral, which is still one of the most painful things I did. I couldn't do.
No. All right. Well, why don't we take a break? This is Steve Hunyar, East County Underground. We'll be back after these commercial messages. Welcome back to the East County Underground. You're listening to a special edition of the program. We are running late intentionally so this evening. I have on my program my parents, Chubba and Gisela Hunyar, have joined us to talk about their life growing up in what was originally a democratic society in Hungary, which eventually converted to a communist society. And eventually they escaped during the Hungarian, or just after the Hungarian Revolution. Obviously, they came here. I'm first generation American. I was born here. And let me ask you both a very important question. I know that through very hard work, and I saw it growing up, Dad had three jobs. Mom, you worked for there was a time where you worked on top of providing, you know, taking care of Maria and I. And Dad, of course. And you've done extremely well for yourself. I mean, if anybody, you know, you are the consummate legal immigrant success story.
Thank you.
Your education, you worked hard, you did what was necessary. You put my sister Maria and I through college. You know, we obviously have done pretty well for ourselves. Do you consider yourselves Americans or Hungarians?
Oh, definitely Americans. We are Americans of Hungarian origin, Hungarian birth, but we are Americans.
Mom?
Yeah, we are Americans.
What about Hungarian American?
No such a thing. We are
Americans. I have to tell you the one thing. I feel totally American. So I am every night I pray to God this country will survive what we are doing now for my children and my grandchildren. Which I am very happy that my kids, even Maria, and you were born here, because you cannot completely wipe off the memories and the growing up in Hungary.
Sure.
So you never 100% here.
Hmm.
How can I explain? It's very difficult.
Hungary is still your homeland.
No, I am much more worried and much more interested in what's happening here than in Hungary.
Oh,
not all Hungarians.
That's an interesting perspective. That's
what I feel. But certain things I really miss over there. Not physical things. It's just memories.
Connections, memories. Sure.
Memories, family, which you don't have. And I thank God for every day for that. Because it's always a little bit of guilt feeling. Part of it is guilt that I left my parents.
Sure.
You know.
I didn't realize you did it without telling them. See, I learned that tonight.
You know, well, it's hard to talk.
I know. Like I said, I really appreciate you coming here because people here have no clue.
Yeah.
I didn't live it, so I really don't understand it other than the stories I get from you both.
Don't misunderstand and love this country of my heart because it was very good to me.
Right.
It was really good. And
but you worked hard for that.
What?
You worked hard for that. It wasn't that the country was good for you.
Yeah, but
you got out of the country what you put into
but
it.
But I had the possibility.
Yeah. The opportunity.
The opportunity and the possibility. And your father was very well educated. He can use his knowledge here very well. And it just, the country was very good to me.
Dave, do you know my dad?
It's lovely.
My dad went to UCLA to get a master's in math for fun. Okay, talk about the intellectual. Okay, who does that?
There's nothing fun about math.
No.
Calculus.
Yeah.
Oh, it depends. You have to look at the other way.
All right.
No,
now,
not to me, it isn't. I know it was.
Let's fast forward to what's going on here in America. You've both told me time and time again that you see a lot of the same tactics that are being used by the left in this country being employed on Americans, albeit in a much slower fashion. We've seen a pretty much a systematic erosion of our liberties over the last 40 years with over the last 12 months. The accelerator has been absolutely forced to the floor. Dad, I'm going to ask you two questions. The first question is, tell me, you had a similar occurrence. You saw this in Hungary. What did you call this?
Oh, in Europe, not only Hungary, we call them the salami politics. Because it's your freedom is like a piece of salami. They slice you up a little slice here and there, and a little slice over there. And just a little more slice here and there, and suddenly one day you wake up, there's no salami left.
That's a great analogy. I'm laughing because it's just so funny that you start with a big piece of salami and then a slice, but at the end of the day, it's not that funny.
You wake up that none of your freedom exists anymore. It's all gone. It was sliced up, slice by slice.
Right. Now, you've also told me that you've seen inequities. You know, we have a system of balances in this country, the way that the power, the political structure was set up, the executive, the judicial, and the legislative branches of the government. You know, with the idea that the founding fathers put this together with the idea of checks and balances, that one would keep an eye on the other and prevent one branch from getting too much powerful. Now, you've told me before that when you first came in here, you saw one of the branches exercising what you thought was excess power, and that there's been a power shift, obviously, just in the last year in that. But tell us about your first impressions when you came here, which branch you thought had too much power and why.
I think so, that the judicial branch had too much power. As a matter of fact, it lately became to the point that one single person, the swing voter on the Supreme Court, could announce it and force 300 million Americans to do this, to do that, live like this, live like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in my opinion, was kind of shift into a single person power.
But lately you've seen a change in that.
Oh, yes. I lately seen that this power has shifted from the Supreme Court into the White House. That one single person wants to declare what things can be or cannot be in this country. A good example was, for example, the CO2 situation, when they said that the carbon dioxide is a poison or not poison, and if the Congress doesn't agree with this, then the EPA will tell the people, and who's going to tell the EPA?
Well, the Congress is basically letting the executive branch, letting the president usurp its power, and then they're going along with it.
Yeah,
because the only people that can stop this right now is Congress.
Right, but
it's unbelievable.
They supposedly don't wake up.
Or they're complicit.
Yeah, they are.
I mean,
and they have all these czars who run the country behind the curtains and behind the closed doors.
No, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, Mom.
Okay, and then where is the Congress? What the heck they are doing controlling the executive? Nowhere.
Well, let me ask you this. I've heard you both say this before, too. You've both also maintained that through all the changes in the political that you saw in Hungary, democracy, monarchy, communism, that at the end of the day, there was always, it seemed like, one set of people that always maintained their power. Do you see the same thing here?
Yes, Stephen, it's an interesting thing.
You know, by the way, Dad, sorry. You know, folks, the only person in the entire world that calls me Stephen is my father.
Okay,
No, Dad, it's fine. I'm kidding, but it's just, it's so...
No.
He would use my Hungarian... You know, see, this is the word when I was a kid. He would use Stephen, and I knew I was in trouble. So when I hear it, I kind of cringe.
No,
need the chiropractor.
No,
Dad,
no,
go ahead.
It's not that. Excuse me. It's not that you are Stephen because you are having a show on the radio.
Oh, that's the proper name.
So, yeah,
okay.
You have to use
all right,
again, Steve a little Stevie.
Steven,
no,
but
go ahead, Dad. I'm kidding.
Yeah.
I'm kidding. Same people, the elitists.
In the common system, they declare that everybody is equal. That's true. But the problem is that some people are more equal. You understand what
sure,
that means?
Sure, absolutely. So that is true. Do you see the same thing happening here in America?
Right.
You're seeing that the people in charge, the puppeteers, if you will, are pulling the strings of different people as we
yeah,
go through the course of time?
Yeah, they have rights which we don't supposed to have.
Yeah, well, clearly, right? Congress has their own health care plan while we get stuck
exactly.
with this piece of crap they're trying to shove down our throats, right?
Yeah, and they say, he's not going to get everything. Yeah, it's 2,000-some-odd pages. Maybe he gets 1,500 pages, and then they are in trouble,
yeah,
too.
Well.
Even if it's 2,000 or 1,000, still, it's a bad, bad, bad
okay, now I want to call on your experience. I would like you to listen to the next clip. It is a clip of former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich under the Clinton administration, and he's also a member of Obama's Economic Transition Advisory Board. And here he is talking about health care as though he were the one. This is what he says a president, an honest president or presidential candidate, should say, how he should speak to the American people.
Look, we have the only healthcare system in the world that is designed to avoid sick people. And that's true. And what I'm going to do is I am going to try to reorganize it to be more amenable to treating sick people. But that means you, particularly you young people, particularly you young healthy people, you're going to have to pay more. Thank you. And by the way, we are going to have to, if you're very old, we're not going to give you all that technology and all those drugs for the last couple of years of your life to keep you maybe going for another couple of months. It's too expensive. So we're going to let you die. I'm going to use the bargaining leverage of the federal government. In terms of Medicare, Medicaid, we already have a lot of bargain leverage, to force drug companies and insurance companies and medical suppliers to reduce their costs. But that means less innovation, and that means less new products and less new drugs on the market, which means you are probably not going to live that much longer than your parents. Thank you.
Thank you. Old people die, young people pay, lower prices squelch innovation and any new drug development. And you can you believe these people sitting in the background clapping?
Clapping. Where did this all happen? Where? Where was this speech made?
This is an advisor to President Obama. This is a man that was Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. Mm-hmm. I don't know where the speech was made. It's irrelevant. But the point is, he's the one advising our president.
It's
now, so I want to talk about
unbelievable.
You lived both private health care and you lived national health care. Can you please explain both to me?
Oh, that's very simple.
You have 12 seconds.
Okay. It will take 12 days.
Yeah.
But anyhow, in Hungary, we used to have the state-run medical care. And we used to call it the aspirin and castor oil care. Any ailment above the waist, take 2 aspirin. Any ailment below the waist, take a spoonful of castor oil. And that's what we got. And I hope it won't get there, but as I can see it right now, they are saying that, hey, you don't expect to live as long or whatever. I'm 82 years old. How long am I supposed to live?
Old people die, Dad. Didn't you hear Robert
Everybody
Reich?
Everybody dies.
No, seriously. What happened in Hungary, if you wanted to have a somewhat decent
medical care,
you had to put a lot of money under the table.
You paid for it. So there's a two-tiered system, basically.
Yes.
All right. Definitely.
The people that...
And it's still bad in Hungary because one of my friends in this summer got ill. I told you this.
Yeah.
With the prostate. He had a problem.
An American who was visiting there.
Right. Yep. A Hungarian American who is visiting the relatives. Okay? He got into trouble. And they went into the... They put him in the hospital for a short period of time. Then he came home. And first of all, the wife gave a lot of money, and she said there was no towels, no soap, no dinner, or such a small amount of dinner you can die. Not the necessities. She had to take it into the hospital. The doctor was wonderful. Okay, he was a good doctor. He also got a lot of euro or dollar or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
But he did everything the right thing. And he came home and went for a checkup, said he did everything his doctor mm-hmm. said he had to. But the situation over there in the hospital
was atrocious.
It was atrocious. It wasn't dirty, but it was very poor.
But that's essentially the difference. I mean, this Hungary now is a democracy. I mean, it's basically the people get... Yeah, I know, but it's...
More or less.
They vote.
Yeah, they
the
vote.
The people vote.
Yeah.
And they get to elect whatever government they want to elect.
We voted, too, when the communists were in a rule.
But you can... Hungarians can come and go. I mean, my cousins go to different countries to go skiing.
Yeah.
And it's a different country.
Yeah, it's a different country.
So...
In this way...
But their health care stinks. And they have nationalized health care.
If you have money, you can buy a house, a villa, if you want to.
Right.
If you have the money and you're successful. So there is no restriction in many things.
All right. I want to talk about the whole global warming debacle when we come back. So we're going to take our last commercial break for the evening. This is Steve Hunyar, East County Underground. We're doing a special edition this evening. I hope you stay tuned. We'll be right back after this commercial message. All right. Welcome back to the East County Underground. We're doing a special edition this evening. My parents, Gisela and Chubba Hunyar, are here talking about their experiences growing up. And now we're relating them to what they see going on in current day America. The balance of this program will be commercial free, so I hope you'll stay tuned as we wrap this up. All right, we talked a little bit about healthcare, the situation that you had when you were there, as well as the current situations there. Let's talk a little bit about global warming. You have former Czech Republic Prime Minister Václav Klaus, who has stated on the record that after the Berlin Wall fell in 89, and we saw the demise of what was the Soviet Union, if you will, that the global communists have now come together under this banner of global warming or climate change now, and they're using that as their ideological pitchfork to regain power. Do you both agree with that?
Look here, it's 4 or 5 years ago we traveled in Portugal as tourists. And that time there was general election in Portugal. And in billboards it was displayed that the Communist Party and the Green Party merged. Does that explain it?
So you're saying you actually saw this politically in a country where it's actually happening. What about you, Mom?
Yes, we did see that. Yeah.
Well, but do you agree that that's what's happening?
Yeah, yes. Probably they use it.
Red is green is the new red?
Maybe. Probably. Most likely,
that's a good color.
I guess.
Yeah.
As part of that, of course, and you, Dad, you talked about this a little bit earlier about how indoctrination of the youth has always been a hallmark of these dictatorial regimes. You saw it in communist Hungary. Here's a prime example of the Goracle using global warming to drive a wedge between children and their parents. Listen to this.
There are some things about our world that you know that older people don't know. Why would that be? Well, in a period of rapid change, the old assumptions sometimes just don't work anymore because they're out of date. New knowledge, new understandings are much more widely available sometimes to young people who are in school who aren't weighed down with the old flawed assumptions of the past. Now, don't get me wrong. Your parents and your elders, as you already have figured out, know a lot that you can gain from. But in a period of rapid change, there are times when new understandings are more apparent to young people.
All right, I'm gonna. That's a kind of a terrible clip. It was unfortunately that the recording itself wasn't very good. But there's Al Gore talking to children, telling children basically that you're smarter than your parents. Hitler Youth was one tactic. You said you saw this in Communist Hungary. Do you believe that? Do you believe we're seeing this here in the United States right now?
My opinion is that takeover always starts with indoctrinating the youth. Starting at the very young ages and going through the mid-schools, high schools, and ultimately in the colleges and universities. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm seeing is going on constantly.
Right. Mom?
Yes, exactly. And if the parents are not careful and not open their eyes, all the teachers are saying this warming and blah, 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 blah. And I am not a scientist. I don't know if it's true or not. All I know is if they do that, they completely ruin our economy.
Well, it's...
If they don't go slow, okay, you can do something. You can try to do clean cars and all this, whatever they claim. But what? We will stop doing now what? What they think? I have no idea about this. How are they going to...
Giving billions of dollars to other countries, that's what it is. It's the third world countries with their hand out saying, gimme, 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 don't you think?
Yeah, and everybody is going to be poor.
Ultimately, it's lowering the bar. It's not raising the bar.
No. Ultimately lowering everything.
Excuse me, the idea we're supposed to play the Chinese, not to pollute, with money we borrow from the Chinese for that purpose?
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah. Oh, that's fun.
That's what it is.
Well, let's talk specifically about our current president, President Obama, who I personally have laid out a case on this program in several different situations that I believe he's a Marxist radical or worse. When you look at his associations, you look at who he has appointed to be by his side. You look at people like Robert Reich, what that guy just said, right? And you realize what these people are telling him. You don't hang around these people unless you have a common belief. I don't hang around friends who don't believe similarly to I do, or at least are open-minded about things. I don't go to a church where a priest is spewing hatred against my country, because you know what? First time he did that, I'd stand up and say, see ya, I'm out of here. Don't you dare talk about my country like that.
But he did it. Now he doesn't go to church.
Well, of course not.
Come on.
So anyway, I want you to listen to, there's a couple of clips here I want you to hear. This is... candidate Obama during a debate.
Allegation that Senator McCain's continually made is that somehow my associations are troubling. Let me tell you who I associate with. On economic policy, I associate with Warren Buffett and former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker. If I'm interested in figuring out my foreign policy, I associate myself with my running mate Joe Biden or with Dick Lugar, the Republican ranking member on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, or General Jim Jones, the former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. Those are the people, Democrats and Republicans, who have shaped my ideas and who will be surrounding me in the White House.
All right, that's President Obama during one of the debates talking about who he surrounds himself by. Now I'd like you to listen to President Obama reading from his own book in 1995, Dreams from My Father.
To avoid being mistaken for such a sellout, I chose my friends carefully. The more politically active black students, the foreign students, the Chicanos, the Marxist professors and structural feminists and punk rock performance poets.
All right, so he said, he admitted, right? He wrote it in a book, and then he even did it on the audio, that he associated himself with politically active students, foreign students, Chicanos, and Marxist professors. Why would you do that? Why would anyone do that? Was it, you know, was he trying to sample the other side of the political spectrum? Was it like, oh, I want to hang out with them to get an idea of what they think? No, that's absolutely not the case. It's clear where this guy's ideology is. Let's back that up a little bit with his appointments. Look at his Green Energy Czar Van Jones, one of the self-avowed radical communists. He was fired when people found out about his background. Who else worked in the Obama administration?
And then the third lesson and tip actually come from two of my favorite political philosophers, Mao Zedong and Mother Teresa, not often coupled with each other, but the two people that I turn to most.
All right, that's Anita Dunn, who was the White House communications director until recently. She was also fired. Imagine that. Probably went on to another more lucrative position. She compared Mother Teresa to Mao. Mao has murdered estimated 60 to 70 million Chinese, the greatest mass murder in human history. And she compared him to a saint, to a woman who dedicated the vast majority of her life to taking care of the horribly impoverished. But you look at, let me talk about a few of the other people. Obama science czar John Holdren believes in forced abortions, mass sterilizations, and seizing babies from teen mothers. Regulatory czar Cass Sunstein believes in harvesting human organs without family consent and allowing animals to be represented in court. Safe schools czar Kevin Jennings, an organizer of a group called Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network. Mark Lloyd, the diversity czar, believes in curtailing freedom of speech, redistribution of wealth, and he openly admires Hugo Chavez. You were talking about Venezuela a little while ago, Mom. Senior White House advisor Valerie Jarrett, who has been by Obama's side for many years, another self-avowed socialist. Global warming's czar Carol Browner is well-known socialist working on cap and trade, the nation's single largest tax. Here's the one I would like you both to pay particular attention to, because I think this one probably hits you home more than any other clip I've played on this show.
And we are beginning. We have offices now in Australia and in Switzerland and London, in South America and Africa. We've been working with unions around the world. And what we're working towards is building a global organization. You know, workers of the world unite. It's not just a slogan anymore. It's a way we're going to have to do our work. We're trying to use the power of persuasion. And if that doesn't work, we're going to use the persuasion of power. Because there are governments and there are opportunities to change laws that affect these companies. I'm not naive. We're ready to strike. There are opportunities in America to share better in the wealth, to rebalance the power, and unions and government are part of the solution.
All right, I had a little fun when I put that clip together. That's Andy Stern, the president of the Service Employees International Union. I took those remarks and I spliced them in with the old Soviet Union national anthem.
Yeah.
Just for fun. Yeah. But this man has recorded the most trips to the White House since Obama has taken office. The SEIU has spent over 60, has given Democrat causes, including President Obama, over $60 million to get them elected. And they deployed about 100,000 members of SEIU to get these Democrats and President Obama elected. Here's Obama on the SEIU.
And you had seen that I was willing to stand by your side even when it wasn't politically convenient. Your agenda has been my agenda in the United States Senate. Before debating health care, I talked to Andy Stern and SEIU members. Before immigration debates took place in Washington, I talked with Alcia Medina and SEIU members. Before the EFCA, I talked to SEIU. So we've worked together over these last few years, and I'm proud of what we've done. I'm just not satisfied, because I know how much more we could accomplish as partners in an Obama administration. Just imagine what we could do together. Just imagine what we could do together. Imagine having a president whose life work was your work.
All right. Andy Stern, in that first clip, clearly a communist. Clearly. Everything he said, everything he does, every candidate he supports, he clearly has a global communist vision. Here's President Obama, at the time candidate Obama, basically saying, I don't do anything unless I talk with these people from SEIU first. And that their vision is his vision is their vision. He's basically fully sanctifying that the unions are going to have an enormous place at the table in this country. The unions, by definition, are, we talked about this just briefly, are very much a form of communism in the sense that they don't reward, they don't incentivize, they don't reward better, you know, performance with better pay, and they hold on to the crud. They allow the people who shouldn't be working in industry to continue to work in that industry. This man is, as I said, has visited this White House. Andy Stern's visited the White House more than anybody else. Are you surprised by this? Both of you, go ahead, chime up.
No.
Did you see this before the election?
Yeah, I did that. I did see it. It was when the media doesn't ask a candidate what kind of change we are talking about. That was a big sign that trouble is coming.
What about you, Dan?
You know, first of all, they get the money that they can get to it. So these are the voluntary contributions of union members.
Sure. You know, yeah, voluntary,
an,
right.
Election campaign. And then through this, the power is being taken over. What Andy Stern would do in the total takeover, definitely he would be one of the equals, more equal ones.
One of the power brokers?
Obviously.
Did you see these kinds of tactics being played out in Hungary? Was there a union of sorts or just Communist
everybody,
Party did this?
No, everybody had to be a union member who had a job.
Period.
Otherwise, no.
Public, there were no private sector jobs.
It didn't matter if you work as a clerk. It didn't matter if you were an engineer, a guy who swept the street. It had to be a union member.
Now you have to say that the union belonged to the state. It wasn't working for the individual workers, but belonged to the state.
Okay, do you not see the same association happening here? You're talking a president who won't do anything unless he talks to the union.
So the union dictates the state, ultimately will belong to the state, no?
Is this similar to what you saw?
How about those factories here, you know, which are taken over by the government, and they have union in there. So what does the union fit in there?
Yeah, well, that's the question. This is the nagging question. These are the same tactics that the communists use in communist Hungary when you were growing up, was it not? Workers of the world unite?
Oh, yes.
No, they said that.
But wasn't that a communist slogan?
In Hungary, it happened practically overnight because we had a Russian troop behind them.
Right.
You know, here it's kind of like the salami.
A slice at a time.
It's happening. Every day, a new slice. Every single solitary day, they come up with something which is...
How many new laws went into effect on January 1 in California? What did you say? You told me this today. 270-something new laws?
There's some new laws, you know, because there are people up in Sacramento whose job is to make new laws.
Yeah, but there were...
Do they make any sense or not?
How many of them were there?
It's almost laughable, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it goes to, Mom, it goes to what you said, and it goes to what Dad said, which is that it's salami politics. Yeah. Every new law is just another little piece of salami coming off the overall
salami,
sausage.
But a small one. In Hungary, it happened practically overnight. But here,
it's slow and sure.
Because it's Hungary, it's a small country, and the troops were not in Budapest,
right?
But and not in the cities, but they were everywhere.
Do either of you believe that socialists and communists actually believe in human rights, or do you think it's just simply a means to an end?
Means to an end, and follow the money.
Follow the money.
Who is financing this? The people like Soros.
Yeah, George Soros.
Yeah. I'm sorry to say that he was born in Hungary.
Yeah, well, here's the big loaded question I have for both of you. I have said to you on repeated occasions that I just have a hard time believing that America could follow in the same footsteps that other nations have that have succumbed to socialism and communism. And you both have politely kind of laughed and scoffed at me. And I don't mean that in a rude way. Do you think we are headed this way? Do you think it will actually happen? And do you think it could happen here in the United States?
Steven,
that we could turn socialist, ultimately communist?
Stephen, you wrote a book. Didn't in that book you mentioned the sheep?
Sheeple, yeah.
Isn't that your answer?
Well...
Yeah,
but,
it's very scary, but it can happen.
I didn't live it, okay? Yeah. And the reason I asked you to come on this program is because you both have lived this. You've been through it. You've seen it firsthand. You've been shot. You've had your home taken away. You were told to go work in an acid factory when you did something the state didn't agree with. You were forced into union membership. You were forced to go out and participate in parades you didn't want to, you were told where to work, when to work, how to work, how much you were going to get paid, where to live, what size apartment, what size house you were going to live in, etc. You had basically all your rights taken away in essentially what was one big fell swoop. You're saying it's happening. You believe here, salami politics, a slice at a time. But do you actually in your heart think that there's a good probability that America could ever get to where you got to in Hungary?
I think it could happen, yeah. I don't know about that, but I think it can. Yeah, definitely.
I'm afraid so because the underlying factor in this is fear. And that what drove 300 or 400 million Europeans where they are right now. That's what driving us in the terrorism campaign. It is always fear which connects behind.
You know what happened? Like, they were very proud, and everybody's talking about now, but Dodd quitting and some other Democrat, big Democrat,
oh,
I don't
get a
remember
big job.
The name. And somebody was, and I thought, oh, okay, that's good. You know, Democrat has problem. And somebody pointed out a political, somebody, I don't know who it was exactly, I forgot the name or the face, that what they did, that it was ordered them to do, because now they are able to do whatever they want to and not to care about the people they represent.
Well, right. I mean,
because not, they are not anymore representative. They quit.
Yeah.
But they're still in there in the Senate.
Yeah.
So they can do without caring about. So this is again. I didn't even realize it, and I said, wow, that can be true. And it is true, because there's still going to be a Senate, I think, two more or three more years. I don't know exactly how long.
Yeah.
And now they can...
Well, Dodd's term is up November, but yeah.
Yeah, but they can do whatever they want
sure.
to be that caring about
if,
the
if they know they're, if
the
they've been promised some sweetheart deal down the road someplace, and they're willing to give up their power hold in Washington,
but until they are dead, they can
do whatever they want. They're lame ducks, so but they have the power.
They are not that lame duck. They can vote for a quick health care.
Well, they already did.
But now, and such a thing, because they don't have any more about what the people has to say at home. And I didn't think of it. And then I thought of it, and I said, wow, that's true. You know, that's true. That's absolutely true. So there are ways to control the situation now. Because the House, the Senate is completely controlled by the Democrats. So there is ways there.
Well, for at least the next 9-10 months, anyway.
Well, I hope we're going to have...
Not that I put a lot of faith in the Republicans anymore, either.
No. But too many progressives and the Republicans. Free election.
Well, you know, I want to tell you my deepest thanks to both of you for coming on the program and telling us a lot of your intimate stories that I know were very difficult, some of them, to talk about. I know rehashing these memories in some cases has been very hard. I'm glad you came on the program, Mom, Dad, because I think people needed to hear this. I look at you both as kind of the canaries in the coal mine, if you will. You've lived through this. You've been through it. You've been in and out of it. And you're concerned that there's a good probability that this could happen in this country again. You know, Edmund Burke, the former British statesman and philosopher, kind of was one of the founders of the modern political conservative movement, stated that, quote, those who don't know history are destined to repeat it. And I'm hoping that this program has opened or perhaps even widened a few highs. We can no longer deny, we can't go around with our heads in the sand anymore. We can't deny that America is being, as the president said, fundamentally transformed before our eyes. And he's doing it, and they are all doing it with something of a brash certitude. And it's up to Americans at this point to stop this madness, or we get what we deserve. Next November's elections hopefully will be the first step, and we'll see where it goes from there. I tend to be a little more optimistic than you both do. I have faith that America, maybe it's a faith based in naivete, but I have some faith that Americans will. I think we're starting to see the beginnings of an orderly revolution against the system. And I think at the end of the day, America will be better off for it.